Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into a London-listed investment trust. It's the Rights and Issues Investment Trust. And we're very kindly joined by Dan Nichols, who is the head of strategy for the UK small cap and mid cap team at Jupiter Asset Management, and also the manager of the Rights and Issues Investment Trust. Dan, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
It's a pleasure, Jonathan. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Regular users of the UK Investor Magazine will be aware that Dan presented at one of our virtual conferences earlier on this year. So this podcast is really following on from that and adding some detail to some of the themes that we saw in that presentation. But before we get into the details, Dan, please, would you be able to give us an introduction? First of all, to yourself, as well as the trust, for those people that aren't aware of the Rights and Issues Investment Trust, please.
Yes, of course, yeah. So my involvement in the UK small cap world goes back to 1997, when I started as an assistant fund manager with a firm in the Midlands called Albert E. Sharp. And then in 2001, I joined Old Mutual Asset Managers and had the good fortune to work under a gentleman called Ashton Bradbury, who's frankly a process I think you still see at work today in terms of the mechanics of how we look at the opportunity set and how we think about the companies that we invest in. I've been head of the team, small cap team that is, at Merian from beginning of 2016. And then Merian itself was acquired by Jupiter in 2020. And I moved here and again, I've moved as head of desk. So, you know, upwards of 20 years experience in the UK mid and small cap space. And I suppose my team and I were really excited to take on the management of the Rights and Issues Trust at the beginning of October last year. So Rights and Issues, you know, venerable name and institution, if you like, in the UK small cap space. It was managed prior to Jupiter taking it over by Simon Knott for 39 years and delivered very strong returns over that period, and did so, I think, in a very distinctive way. So the NAV, the net asset value of the trust, currently around 125 million, around 23 holdings as things stand, so a very focused style of management. And that's something that was very much in the DNA of the trust when we took it over after Simon Knott's period of management as well.
Thank you. So we're going to be discussing some of those holdings and the approach a little bit later on in the podcast. But before we get into the details of the trust, Dan, I think it would be good to set the scene, really, and take a quick look at the UK small and mid-cap market at the moment. Of course, it's been a tough period for the market, so it would be good to get your perspective and really the macro view on the UK small caps at the moment, and really sum up why we are where we are in that market at the moment.
Absolutely, sure. Well, I think there's some global factors at play here, and then there's very much some UK specific factors as well. So if I perhaps start with the global picture, because, you know, clearly that affects markets worldwide, we are where we are, I guess, at least in part, because certainly post pandemic we have been in an inflationary period. Inflation has broken out for all sorts of reasons: fewer people in the workforce, supply chain disruption. If you think about other markets, agricultural markets, for the sake of argument, some disruption in that space too. And clearly, the conflict in Ukraine, has had a profound effect on energy prices. So all sorts of inflationary forces have been at play globally, and central banks naturally have had to act to temper those forces, to rein them in, and hopefully put the world in a place where we can continue to see growth, but those inflationary forces are tamed. And that process of rising interest rates has happened pretty quickly, and has had a fairly predictable effect on markets. And I suppose if we think about the UK mid and small cap space in particular, a lot of that world, a lot of the opportunity set has historically at least been in what you might term the growth camp. So you've had a lot of stocks trading on quite elevated multiples relative to history, reflecting a very low interest rate environment historically. As interest rates have risen, we've seen a fairly wide scale derating, companies moving on to lower multiples of their profits as that process has played out. And that, that clearly has affected the UK mid and small cap space, but I suppose markets generally. So I suppose that's the big picture background. If we think about the UK more specifically, I think, I suppose the challenges that I've just described have been compounded to some degree by a couple of further dynamics here. So I think, and it's difficult to be precise about this, but, there's no doubt, I think, that if we go back to 2016, the result of the referendum has, I think, confused global investors as to where the UK stands. The exit from the EU, has proceeded over time. But I think it's probably fair to say that over that intervening period, the UK is yet to forge a definitive new trading relationship with the wider world. And I think for that reason, rightly or wrongly, so fairly or unfairly, the UK is regarded as a bit of a curate's egg for the time being. And I think there's been another factor at play. So UK investors, UK pension funds, UK private wealth managers just systematically have been disinvesting from the UK over an extended time period. And the reason they've done that is that they've just taken a more, if you like, global view around the way in which their clients' portfolios should be structured. So very loosely over that time period, you've seen, the typical UK pension fund allocations to UK equities going from something like 35-40% to something like 5% now. So a very significant disinvestment. And so if you bring all of that together, what that's broadly meant is that the UK mid and small cap space has undergone a profound derating over time. So it is rated much more cheaply now than it was historically. We look on a 12-month forward basis, the PE ratio of the UK small cap space, depending on exactly how you want to define it. So the UK, the FTSE small cap, trading on a 12-month forward PE of about 8.5 times. And over most of my career, it's traded on about 13, 14. So, that gives you a flavour of the extent of the derating. So that's really kind of where we are and how I think we've come to be there.
Thank you. So I just want to take the factors that you outlined there, Dan, and then look at the trust and look at the overarching management style of the investment trust. And, of course, we've looked there at the macro picture. So that really leads on to the question of how much of that macro picture do you apply to your selection strategy in terms of it being a more top-down managed portfolio compared to the bottom up of looking at stock selection first? How does that all fit in?
Yeah, good question. So I referenced earlier in the discussion, I suppose the team that I've had the good fortune to work in, and I perhaps touched very briefly on the process. The process that we as a team use has always been this combination of top-down and bottom-up analysis. So we, I suppose, philosophically believe that it's really important always to try and identify what top-down dynamics are at play so that you can better position the portfolios to capture the prevailing thematic trends within markets at any point in time. Because there will always be, I think, sort of key trends that you need to be aware of. And to a certain extent, that top-down analysis will also inform a view as to which sectors are likely to perform better or worse and why. So we've always had that dynamic within the management of all of the portfolios that we've run. Obviously, in the context of the rights issues trust, as of last October, we inherited a portfolio from Simon Nott, who, as I mentioned before, had run the portfolio for nearly four decades. And at that point in time, if you think about the makeup of the portfolio that Simon had put together, it was, I think deliberately from Simon, but it was quite tilted towards industrials, to distributors, but there weren't really, for example, there wasn't much exposure to areas of the market like financials, like the consumer, like support services, and probably only a limited amount of exposure to technology as well. So again, we've taken the view that we probably tended to want, from a portfolio construction process, to have some exposure to most sectors over time. And really the only theme, if you like, that we've typically avoided as a management team or as a team of portfolio managers is to, early stage, pre-profit, pre-revenue sort of medical, and pharmaceutical type businesses. We've tended to eschew that part of the market, but generally everything else has been fair game. So I suppose to come to back to your question, I'd like to encourage listeners to think about, our approach to portfolio construction and the management of rights issues now as being very much a balance between top-down and bottom-up analysis.
Thank you. So you did allude to it there in terms of the sectors that the portfolio is invested in, that, and that's something that I'd just like to pick up on, because if you're looking at that balance between top down and bottom up, and we will discuss later on in the podcast individual holdings, individual stocks within the portfolio, but of course when you're balancing the top down to bottom up, one of the big decisions is the sectors that you're going to be in, and you did mention some there that had traditionally been in the portfolio and some that were in there now, but it's something that I think we should just focus on for a minute if we may, Dan, in terms of what were, when you took over, that the main sectors within that, and how have you really molded the portfolio to the way that you see the world playing out, and which sectors have you added to the portfolio since you've been managing it?
Yeah. Okay. So I think, as I mentioned a few moments ago, the portfolio was quite heavily exposed to sectors like engineering, to electronics, to distributors in particular. Those were, I think, areas that Simon felt were particularly attractive. And we don't necessarily disagree with that. I think, in terms of some of the new holdings that we've introduced and some of the sectors and themes therein, I think one of the opportunities that has, I suppose, presented itself to us when we think about the UK mid and small cap opportunity set now. I mean, I referenced in the opening comments the fact that we'd seen a pretty significant derating across a lot of our market as a result of rising interest rates generally. So longer duration, typically growth orientated businesses, that have, over much of the 20 teens, if I can call it that, during that period of very low interest rates, they had rated onto high multiples. Over the course of the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen a fairly profound derating. And I think that's presented us, in our view, with an opportunity to acquire positions in what we think are really attractive growth businesses at multiples or at profit multiples not far above, the market average. So it's really sort of quite unique point in time where we think you can access, attractive businesses on these sorts of very attractive multiples. And in a sense, it slightly transcends sectors. I mean, we can, as I'm sure you'd like to, talk about some of these holdings individually. But I think what we're driving at here is that across a range of sectors, we've been able to identify growth businesses, you know, at these attractive multiples. So I think that has been one of the key sort of standout features. And, you know, the sorts of areas that we have built some of these new positions in include technology, include financials, include actually, bizarrely, because, you know, you'd think that utilities wouldn't be necessarily the sort of place you could find, in inverted commas, a growth business. But again, that's one of the new holdings that we've introduced as well. So there's been, I suppose, you know, a range of new positions added that we think have given, you know, an interesting sort of stock level dynamic, but have also served to broaden the array of sectors that are represented across the portfolio now.
Thank you. So before we move on to discuss individual holdings within the portfolio, which we will do later on in the podcast, it would be good if we could discuss, Dan, for a moment, the construction. Because you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, there's 23 holdings within the portfolio. So it's a highly concentrated, high conviction portfolio. Why do you feel this is the most appropriate approach to small caps? You know, of course, there are some portfolios out there which have many more, double, maybe even triple the number of holdings that you would have in the portfolio. So why do you feel that is the best way to go, by having a highly concentrated portfolio across just 23 holdings? And what does that mean for the portfolio? And what should investors expect from the returns from the portfolio over time? I'm just sort of looking back over the past 10 years, 144% increase in the value of rights and issue versus a benchmark of 79%. That's across a 10-year period. But if you look over 5 years, there's a bit more variability in those returns between the benchmark and the portfolio. I think that has something to come down to that approach. It'd be good if you'd be able to speak to, you know, what that means for returns of the portfolio and why you feel that's the best way to approach the small cap market by having it highly concentrated.
Sure, yeah, okay. Well, I mean, I think candidly, there's a degree of chicken and egg here in the sense that when we were pitching for the mandate to manage this trust in the summer of 2022, the Rights and Issues Board, I think, were very clear that they wanted a management team that was philosophically, you know, wanting to, if you like, remain faithful to, consistent with the DNA of the trust as it had been, you know, established over a long period under the management of Simon Knott. And I suppose from our perspective, while within our current sort of Jupiter guise, we don't manage highly focused portfolios in our open-ended funds, over time, the team has managed sleeves of best ideas portfolios for other entities. So the team has the, you know, real world experience of managing successfully highly focused 10 stock portfolios over, you know, a long period of time. So, you know, we think there's a really nice alignment here in the sense that, and I suppose to touch on the returns point as well, all else equal, if you get your, you know, stock selection, and indeed, you know, if you get the, I suppose, the top-down element right as well, but if you get the stock selection element right with a focused portfolio like this, then certainly over the longer term, I think you should legitimately expect superior returns to come through. And I think, you know, that hopefully, or certainly in our experience internally at least, was borne out by some of the best ideas portfolios that we managed over time. So I think the prospect of being able to deliver very attractive returns through the medium of concentrated high conviction portfolios is something that we feel is realistic and, you know, we should be able to achieve. So I think, you know, it's the marriage of those factors. I think the fact that, you know, let's say the Board of Rights and Issues really were keen to preserve and maintain that approach, and we were keen to, I suppose, utilize once again the skills that we think we have in terms of putting together focused portfolios, but with an eye to thematic balance as well. You know, I think we felt there was a real alignment of those elements. And again, we do feel from a returns perspective that, again, over the long term, we should see real value for that approach.
Thank you. So let's now move on, Dan, into individual holdings within the portfolio. And I think we should start with ones that you've added to the portfolio. Of course, you took over management last year, so it would be good to get an insight into the types of companies that you've added to the portfolio since then and some of the ones that excite you the most.
Yes, certainly. So again, just to set the general context, within those 23 positions currently in the trust, eight of them are ones are new names that we have added. And we've disposed of what I characterise as, you know, perhaps a small tail of about four or five positions as well. And we've resized some of the larger positions in the portfolio. So I suppose from a general overall architecture of the portfolio, what we're trying to, I suppose, get towards, what we're trying to put in place is a situation where every single one of the positions in the portfolio, you know, very much counts. You know, it's going to ultimately make a difference. And I suppose just to flesh that out more, over time, you know, I think we are, again, sort of in the process of just working towards that. But I suppose you typically expect to see units in the portfolio range from at the bottom. And bear in mind, you know, we're playing across the wider UK mid and small cap space. So selectively, we are prepared to play in some, you know, some smaller market cap businesses over time as well. So very broadly, I think you might expect the range of positions to be from, say, 2.5% of the portfolio up to about 7.5%. I think that's the broad architecture that you might expect over time. If we think about some of the new positions that we have put into the portfolio, I think in aggregate, not exclusively, but overall, the broad sort of thrust, the flavour, the sort of theme that I think we have introduced is one of structural growth at an attractive valuation. The sorts of stocks that I think fit into that broad descriptor would be things like Telecom Plus, Gamma Communications, Alpha Group International, and Gresham Technologies, and more latterly, Oxford Instruments. But we have introduced names like One Savings Bank, so obviously a specialist financial business, but which, you know, trades at anything but a growth multiple. It's a specialist buy-to-let lender which trades on a 2024 price earnings multiple of about 4x. So very much inverted commas value stock, you know, that trades, you know, at what we think is a very, very attractive multiple given its prospects over time. So I suppose hopefully that gives you a flavour of the broad thrust. And maybe if I can pick out two or three of those names to just try and, I suppose, exemplify some of the dynamics that we have picked up over the course of a year or so in charge of the trust. I suppose the first name I want to touch on would be Telecom Plus. So this is best described as a reseller, a multi-utility reseller, to use the jargon. So it trades under the Utility Warehouse brand. You may have seen some of their, you know, vehicles darting around in your local area. But what this business does is to use a network of agents to resell domestic utilities, so to householders, primarily energy, but also things like telephony, mobile, and more latterly, insurance. And the big picture attraction of this stock is the fact that as we're talking now, they've got probably about 900,000 customers across the UK, so about a 3% share of UK households. And again, in very big picture terms, we see no reason why over time, so on a 3 to 5 year view, they can't double that market share. And if you believe that, then quite simply, you know, this is going to be a materially bigger business on that time frame than it currently is. And I suppose the attraction over and above that is that the starting valuation of this business, I don't think is particularly high for the growth that is likely on offer. So on a March 25 basis, it trades on a PE multiple of about 14 times, but already yield, so dividend yield in that year, still a shade over 5%. You've got a really nice combination of growth characteristics with, you know, an attractive dividend yield as well. So I think that would be one particular name I'd pick out. And the other, I think, would be something like Gamma. So this is, a technology business or a telecoms business, which specializes in so-called cloud telephony. So this is effectively using the internet as the medium over which telephony is actually sort of provided, rather than traditional ISDN lines or the old-fashioned telecoms infrastructure. And quite simply, well, the reason we like this business is that it continues to take share from some of the slower-moving incumbents like BT, like Openreach. And it serves business customers from one-man bands up to medium and even large businesses and government departments as well. So again, in big picture terms, we think this is a business which can grow sustainably at low double-digit rates. And on a, again, a December 24 basis, it trades on a PE multiple of about 13.5 times. So attractive growth at, we think, you know, a pretty low multiple for that growth on offer. So, you know, again, big picture theme here, having, I suppose, inherited a portfolio which was very much geared towards perhaps more lowly valued industrial businesses, just trying to balance those exposures out through attractively priced but very strongly growing businesses as well.
Thank you. So there was one holding which has really taken my interest, and that's Marshalls. And it's for a number of reasons, because it's a products business. You know, it's slightly different to the technology businesses, industrials that you have there that are providing a service. Maybe not classed as a growth stock. There may be an argument there that it could be a value play, looking at its growth figures and current valuation. You know, how has that made its way into the portfolio? And could that be a sign of things to come from rights and issues, that you're quite happy to broaden the net and look at lots of different companies and add them to the portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've very much touched on, certainly, I suppose, some of the sort of philosophy behind, you know, the sorts of names we would consider. So to be clear, in terms of, you know, if we think about our UK mid and small cap opportunity set, there's very little which is, you know, ultimately out of bounds. We're, I think, pragmatic, and we will consider, you know, everything on its own merits. So I suppose why Marshalls, or, you know, what particularly attracted us to Marshalls? Firstly, it's a market-leading business in our view. So it is the UK leader in blocks and paving, you know, if in the construction space. And more latterly, via acquisition, it bought a business called Marley, which is, again, the UK leader in roofing systems. So, you know, tiles and the like, but it also has a solar panel business that goes with that. So we're attracted by the leading position. But, you know, predictably, or I suppose understandably, given what's happened to construction markets generally over the course of the last 2 or 3 years, firstly with the pandemic, but also then I think with challenges resulting from what's happened to interest rates generally, challenges within house building markets and construction markets, this business is currently in a cyclical downturn. So I suppose one of the attractions of the rights and issues structure, it being obviously closed-ended, is that we can selectively, I think, afford to take a maybe slightly opportunistic but long-term view about certain businesses. And what we identify in Marshalls is that, you know, very broadly, profits are probably slightly less than half what they were now at peak in 2019. So we do think over the course of the next 2, 3, 4, perhaps it's impossible to be totally precise about this, but there's every reason to believe that as market conditions begin to recover, then Marshall's profits also should recover. And if Marshall's can attain once more the sort of mid-teens PE multiple that it traded on, well, if you look at, you know, the sorts of earnings it delivered in 2019, very roughly about 30 pence of earnings, you put that on a mid-teens multiple that it, you know, historically has traded on, we think there's a really nice opportunity to find a well-managed business that can, you know, see earnings recover really very strongly over the course of the next 2, 3 years. And with re-rating, you know, we'd broadly see the opportunity for that share price to double over that time period. But again, very difficult to be, you know, mechanistic, precise about exactly how that plays out. But within the rights and issues structure, I think it's a really nice complement to some of the other sort of ideas that we've introduced to the portfolio. So perhaps some of the more steadily growing structural growth plays that we've introduced.
Thank you very much. So to finish off now, Dan, we were talking at the beginning of the podcast about the macro picture and the environment for UK small and mid caps at the moment. So for the final point, I'd like to ask you about the coming 12 to 24 months, again, from a macro perspective, and what your view is on the outlook for the market, the small cap market. And what do you feel are the catalysts that we need to see to really fire this market back up again?
Yeah, sure. Well, look, I mean, I think, you know, we're always, I suppose, looking for, hoping for catalysts. I think the most obvious reason to be positive on the UK mid and small cap space is perhaps one we've already touched on, and that's valuation. Valuations have contracted very materially over the course of the last 6, 7 years. And I think in part, again, as I referenced before, fairly or unfairly, the UK has been regarded as something of an anomaly. You know, we look at developed world economies generally. And I think more latterly, the evidence is beginning to build that actually, notwithstanding some of the political changes and perhaps some of the political turbulence that we've had over the course of the last, you know, 6 or 7 years, with what, 5 prime ministers since 2016 and a lot of ministerial changes to boot as well. Actually, if you look at some of the more recent data, that would suggest that the UK is continuing to perform broadly in the pack with the rest of, say, the G7 in terms of both inflation and growth. And I think to the extent that data picture, if you like, continues to build out, I see no reason why the UK should continue to be valued at a, you know, material premium to the rest of the developed world. And that process is not going to happen in an instant, but I think it's more of a drip feed. You know, the more we get that data that suggests we're not so very different, I think the more the marginal investor begins to look back at the UK and thinks, okay, you know, there's no reason why this, you know, particular market should continue to be rated at the sort of discount that currently prevails. And I think, you know, if we think about some of the more sort of tangible measures of late, you know, the recent autumn statement, you know, I think has taken or seen some useful initiatives that help the supply side of the economy. You know, if we think about the generous capital allowance program, which has now been, if you like, sort of made permanent, you know, good reasons to believe why over time that should enhance the productive capacity of the UK economy. And even in recent days, you know, we've seen the government launch a much more concerted initiative to attract foreign direct investment, which has been notably less potent for the economy over recent years, as as it was, pre the referendum vote. So I think plenty of reasons to believe that, as I say, the UK will increasingly be perceived as part of the mainstream of the developed world. And to the extent that, that is the case, I think we can expect, a re-rating to come through as well. And I think as a final observation, clearly we're likely to have an election over the course of calendar 24. As things currently stand, at least, it seems likely that we will have a change of government. It's difficult to argue that elections are necessarily positive catalysts in themselves, but I think what we can legitimately point to here is the idea that the Labour Party, I think, have signalled fairly clearly that they're going to adopt a conventional and arguably pretty technocratic approach to trying to manage the economy. So I don't think there are reasons, again, why a change of government should cause the UK to be viewed as outside of the mainstream of the developed world. So again, this is going to be a gradual process, but I see, a real opportunity for the UK mid and small cap space to re-rate positively over time. And we think the combination of attractively valued structural growth and, industrial, more economically sensitive businesses on low starting valuations represent an attractive combination in the Rights and Issues Trust. So we feel pretty good about prospects over the course of the next 12 months.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Dan. Just a note to listeners, do check out the notes to this podcast because there will be a link through to the Rights and Issues website where you'll be able to find further information, look at the top 10 holdings and download the fact sheets. But there'll also be a link through to the recent presentation that Dan gave at the UK Investor Magazine Virtual Investment Trust Conference. That's in the video section of the UK Investor Magazine website, as well as a link in the notes to this podcast. So Dan, thank you for being on the podcast today.
That's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember all investment involves risk.